This is ILTA Radio, the source for legal technology practices and ideas to help your career delivered to fit your busy schedule. ILTA Radio, get tuned in.
Hi, this is another installment of the Trial Support Series A to Z. This is Chris Acosta from Nostman, Director of Practice Support, and I have Christopher Puente.
Hello, I'm Chris Puente. I'm the Lit Support Manager for Shepherd Mullin Richter in Hampton.
Great. So today we will be talking about courtroom and war room technology. First off, just some of the things that you should think about before you actually go on site, and some of the things that may come up when you're finally there during trial. So Chris, let's talk first about war room technology and kind of the things that you might want to think about before you actually get there on site.
One of the things that we do is to really look at the location of where that courtroom is in relationship to where the war room is going to be. So we try to make site visits. We try to drive to different hotels if we're going to be staying at a hotel and create a war room there. We also look at office space. I think that's really important. If the courtroom is further away from the hotel that you're staying at, if that's off-site, an office space near the courthouse is also a good thing to do to determine whether that's a viable option for you. Some of the things that you want to take into account is, do they have that infrastructure there to support a full-on war room? Mm-hmm. Talking about computers, having the ability to have enough bandwidth to take multiple computers there in a courtroom, or excuse me, in a war room, to allow to have good connectivity between you and your office. Also, does it have after-hour support? Is there an engineer on call if something goes down with the power or with the internet feed? I think those are the things that you want to think about when you're looking at war rooms.
Yeah, one of the things too that we also look at is if we can actually get one of the witness prep rooms at the courthouse too. So sometimes there may be an adjacent room to the courtroom, and if you are able to talk with the case clerk and can get that before the opposing party, you know, that can also be kind of a small war room in case you actually have to go back and forth and it's right there and it's easily accessible. Well, part of the other things too I would include would be security, making sure that your war room is fully secure. The only people that have access to the war room sometimes may not even be the hotel staff. It should only be the trial team, just because there's a lot of sensitive information, a lot of expensive technology there. So you kind of want to make sure that it's fully controlled and the only people that are able to access it would be the people that are supposed to. Probably the other thing too would be, like you touched on the engineering. So like if you have a multifunction copier or anything too, you know, sometimes those take up a lot. They have a fully different power plug, and yeah, you essentially would need something that would be able to compensate for that. So you might want to take that into account.
I wanted to circle back to security. I think that's a good point, Acosta. I think part of security is also in that war room. How do you get rid of documents? We know a lot of attorneys will print out docs because they want to review them. Mm-hmm. And what do? You just dump that in your hotel trash bin? Hopefully not. Hopefully you take that and you have somebody, a service come out and have a locked bin that you can dispose of that material there. They'll take it offsite and shred it. I think that's something that is not often thought about, because you just think, oh, it's going to get thrown in the trash and it should be fine. But, stranger things have happened. So I would suggest having some kind of service come out and take those materials away from you.
Yeah, and that's a good point, knowing exactly where it's going to go. So a shredding bin is definitely something you want to keep on like your equipment checklist when you're preparing for your war room. And, I think going back to now, just having a checklist and starting to just list everything that you may need, and also just compensate for everything, not only from the technology, but the office supplies to just, you really need to think everything out, and everything kind of goes with the whole war room. I think part of it too is you also have to consider shelving if you have a small or limited space, and then sometimes even creating just a rough blueprint of what the room would look like, because you may have everyone in one section of the war room, but then you may have witness prep on another, or if you're lucky, you can get another room, then you may use that room then for witness prep, but then you would have to set up a number of different things too, just to keep that supported.
Yeah, ultimately, I think what you want to do is make that environment the most comfortable that can it be under the circumstances. You made a good point about having that separate room. Normally what we'll do is we'll rent out in giant, you know, the largest suite that we can get for that hotel, and then we'll move some of the furniture out of there, whether we move the bedroom set out of there and they put that in storage, and then we move some couches in, and that'll be a witness prep room, or that may be a room in which the client and the lead attorneys go in there and speak while the rest of the team is outside in the main room working on the presentation for the next day. So I think ultimately what you want them to do is to be able to have an environment that mimics not only just the office, but really mimics the most comfortable environment they get to have under the circumstances.
And I think alluding to that also is that sometimes you may not even have a conference room available depending on where the trial is, and you may just be left with a regular hotel room. And I think to your point of being able to move out certain furniture and everything else, always consider that a possibility if you don't have a conference room available for you to use. There's been a number of trials where we've had to turn another hotel room into a full-blown war room. And, you know, usually the hotels, if you talk to them early enough, they're more than willing to accommodate that.
Yeah. Let's move on to trial. We know we've prepped our war room. We've got that ready. What are some of the things that you do on your end, Acosta, or you and your team do to prep for trial?
I think so in regards to the war room, you know, a lot of it is just prepare for the unexpected. Yeah, you always want to make sure that you have spare equipment, or if you're working with a certain vendor, that they're at least aware that if something does break down, that you need a very quick turnaround to get it prepared. A lot of times, too, you have something like a multifunction copier. You may have a separate printer, so that way you can do high-speed printing on one, and then you'll have at least some kind of redundancy. If, like, one of them happens to go down, then at least you can churn out documents or whatever it is you need for trial binders at that time. So I think, you know, the redundancy, and then just making sure you've thought about a number of different things, from cables to extension cords, you know, that always does come up.
Yeah, I think even something like spare laptops, spare desktops, mm-hmm. You hope those don't ever go down, but they may, and it's good to have those on site.
Yeah, and it's true. I've had an experience where you'd be at trial and you don't have that spare laptop and just some kind of redundancy. Should anything go down, you really have to be able to turn around quickly and be able to boot up, you know, whatever it is. And it doesn't have to just even be your laptop. If it's one of the trial attorneys, you know, you don't want them to be just sitting there. You want them to be able to be plugged in. And so you really need to account for just spare equipment, so that way everyone's constantly up and running because everything is time sensitive. Now, in terms of like trial, I know we also talked about security and everything else. So, you know, one of the things too with the security, right, it's always keeping in mind that you should lock your equipment. What about like flash drives and stuff?
Yeah, I mean, part of that is do you encrypt those? You know, I would say yes. I think a lot of times when we're running our databases, our trial presentations, is our laptops will be locked, but if you lay flash drives around at your station in the courtroom or in the war room, is there any concern that somebody may get a hold of that? So you may want to, you should encrypt those flash drives, those hard drives, absolutely.
Yeah, and if you happen to have something like Windows 7 or more recent, there is BitLocker to go that you can have enabled on your computer, and that would automatically encrypt any kind of flash drives that you're using. So at least then it is a lot easier for you to actually have secure flash drives, because during trial you'll have about 10 or 20 of those running around everywhere, and you want to make sure that you can account for them. And if you can't account for them, then at least you know that they're encrypted, because they may have personal identifiable information or anything of that sort. What about the technical support? How do you normally handle tech support during trial?
So we work with vendors in terms of rental equipment for the courtroom, actually, and the war room. And so we always have emergency numbers on hand to make sure that they can come out at any time that we need, whether it's 3 o'clock in the afternoon or 3 a.m. It's important to be able to keep your systems up and running. So we keep contact with emergency contact numbers for those vendors, as well as the engineers that are assigned to the hotels that we're at. I think that's important. the courtroom, obviously, it's usually an 8 to 5 p.m. access only, so that's really not that much of an issue. We do make sure that we talk to the court personnel to see who their engineer is on staff, and with the understanding if something goes down, we'll be able to get a hold of them to help us through that day.
One thing too that sometimes what you try to keep in mind is during trial is you always try to, again, preparing for the unexpected. If, say, the internet goes down, can you actually be autonomous without having to rely solely on the internet? A lot of times, too, you may have your trial exhibits and everything else on a local server that you may have within the war room itself. And that way, at least, should the internet ever go down, which sometimes it does, you are able to still function and still access everything without having to rely on getting on Relativity through a vendor or anything else like that.
I think that's a good point. Not only to have a standalone system, but not only your depot exhibits, your trial exhibits, your depot transcripts. I think those are all important things to have locally as well, just in case you have some issue connecting.
Exactly. So I guess we can move on to courtroom technology. So differing from the war room, you're not able to take as much equipment to your courtroom. And the focus really is going to be primarily on the jury and making sure that they are able to comprehend the story of the trial team. But even before you get to that point, pre-trial, what are you normally doing to kind of prepare for the courtroom?
We always try to get out there at least a week or two before trial to talk to the court clerk, find out if the judge has any standing orders, make sure that we get a good lay of the land. What equipment do we need to bring in? Does the courtroom have projector and screen? Does the jury box have a good line of sight to the screen? What about the witness? Can the witness see the screen, or will they need a monitor there? Does the judge need a monitor? One of the things that we do is we also look at where are the power outlets? How are we going to run our cables? We have to make sure we tape them down. Nobody wants to be in a situation where a witness or a jury member trips over one of your lines, so you have to make sure you know how that's going to lay out, and you want to tape that down. We literally spend a few minutes even just sketching the courtroom to make sure that we have a good understanding of what we have there. I think it's really important to, when you get there, to really make an effort to connect with the court clerks. They're really going to be the ones that are going to help you through that whole process and give you the time to look over the courtroom. Do you find that to be the same on your end, Acosta?
Yeah, no, definitely. I think with the court clerk, you want to make friends as soon as possible, because one is, just like you said, you want to be able to scope out the courtroom. Two, you may want to actually test out the trial equipment that's already built into the courtroom, and that also means testing every monitor, same thing. So you do want to make sure that you have a good relationship with the court clerk, so that way, if there's anything that comes up, you may need to come in a little earlier on any given day for the trial. They're willing to bend over backwards to kind of just let you in, or at least to give you some insight of what the judge likes and what he or she does not like. So that's definitely needed for this. And I think part of it too is just even figuring out where you're going to put all your trial exhibit binders in your boxes. Even though that's not courtroom technology, but it does affect how you lay out your technology, because a lot of times you have a lot of boxes, and it may directly affect what kind of location you can put your monitors or your projection screens. Projection screens.
Yeah, and I think part of that is one of the things that we also do besides just sketching out that courtroom is we'll test some video for sound. We'll sit in the jury box. We'll sit in the witness box and play that sound. We'll actually even take some photographs. We all have smartphones, so we take some photographs of what it looks like from different positions, and we email that to the case team just to kind of get their input and see what they think about how it's laid out. We do those things just because we want them to understand when they get in the courtroom what should they expect. One other thing that I want to add that I think is really important, and I've used this ever since I started doing trials, is I think it's important when you think about showing your trial exhibits to have the ability to shut down the feed to the jurors there are exhibits that may not be admitted yet. And so what I do is I'll get a switcher mm-hmm. with multiple distribution amps and be able to cut off that feed to the jurors so that only the judge and the witness can see it. And both, you know, parties can argue whether it's coming in or not. And when the judge gives its approval to admit, then you hit that switch and you're able to, the juror is able to see it. We've had many judges who have been very pleased that we have the ability to do that. You know, the old school way is basically going up with a printed exhibit and showing it the judge or having the judge open up the binder. I think that's just way more efficient and faster. Is there any, do you do anything different than that, Acosta?
No, I think that's exactly what we do. And what I've seen too is that some judges may like it, but a lot of them too have that as a requirement that they do want to take a look at the exhibit before it's actually lodged. And that's something you definitely want to keep in mind during trial. You know, as you start to present exhibits, is that you kind of want to wait for the judge to give the direction or give the approval before you go ahead and start to put up an exhibit. And so kind of going back to the trial team's needs, the one thing too that we should also touch on is real-time feed for the transcripts. How do you normally handle real-time feed, and then what kind of applications do you normally use?
So we use a CaseViewNet to get a real-time feed. We'll take that and bring that into TextMap so that our attorneys can review that later and either make some edits or use some excerpts of that either the next day or later that afternoon, depending on when we receive that transcript.
So do you normally use your own laptops, or do you sometimes use like maybe those court reporter may have small little laptops or iPads?
You. We haven't used that. We always use our own laptops. Are you using the court reporter's equipment on that end?
I find that sometimes it may just ease out the complexity of setting up our own laptops just because of there's so many different, you know, real-time protocols nowadays that sometimes it's just easier to use theirs, and that at least then that you just cut out any other complexity, especially with, you know, some trial teams, they just don't want to deal with it. And, you know, having a small iPad or those mini laptops, what they find appealing about that is it's not taking up too much real estate on the counsel table. So that's something that they definitely want. And, you know, eventually what we do is we'll end up getting the dirty script after the day of trial, and then we'll go ahead and load that for the trial team so they can get started on reviewing the transcript. Have you guys ever done real-time feeds for trial where the team may be back in the office?
We haven't done real-time feedback to the office. It's usually counsel's during trial, and we'll have either a second chair will be the one taking notes and annotating that transcript as it's fed into his or her laptop. Okay. How about you? Have you?
We haven't had a chance to do that. I think for the most part, what we try to do is as things come in, we may have someone sitting with a laptop in the back and then communicating with the office, I guess that which also leads to another point of internet access within a courtroom. From my experience, it's always a hit or miss. Sometimes the judge, like I know in federal court, sometimes they just won't allow you to have internet access, whereas you may be in state court and they definitely have internet access for you to use. And sometimes if you rely on their internet access, same thing, it may be hit or miss that it may disconnect you. How's your experience been with, say, internet access control?
I think for state court, we run into that very issue. Interestingly enough, we'll always make sure that we have a local copy of that database, that transcript database as well, so that our attorneys can go through and run searches, run some tagging, and be able to do some get some material for a witness. So I think it's important to have an actual local version because, again, like you said, you never know what's going to happen with internet feed.
That's true. And then part of it, too, is if it does go down, you may want to consider bringing maybe a MiFi or using your phone as a personal hotspot, just in case the internet does go down. So if they do allow you to use the internet in the courtroom, make sure you have that in mind so that way if the courtroom's internet goes down, you have a redundant connection.
How do you deal with sharing equipment with the other side, Acosta? Before, obviously, you're preparing for trial, you've looked at the courtroom, now you are putting together your equipment list, you know what your needs are. How do you guys on your end deal with sharing equipment with opposing counsel?
Personally, I always look forward to it because it cuts the cost in half. And that also allows for better buy-in with the trial team, because if you tell them I can cut the cost in half, for them being zealous advocates, that's probably one of the big, I guess, areas that they definitely agree on, because of the fact that if they cut costs for both their clients, they're willing to do so. I would say that that's something you want to get the communication with opposing counsel's IT person or lit support person early, so that way you can start the negotiation and see whether or not they're amenable for certain equipment. Because just like with the attorneys, you also will have to negotiate and compromise and agree upon the type of equipment that's there and make sure that they're on the same page, especially if you're sharing the cost. There may be certain things that they may want. There may be certain things that you don't need, you know, and that's something you at least want to have ironed out before you even get to trial.
And I think we all go into trial with the understanding that the other side is the adverse party, but there is something to be said about working with the other side, whether it's working on pulling together the equipment for the courtroom. I've noticed with my experience with working with the other side, with my attorney's blessing, is the ability to share exhibits. So new exhibits come in, they have a copy, their electronic version, and they're going to hand us a paper version. Well, the paper version never looks as good as the original or the electronic version. And if you're working with the other side, they sometimes are just happy to just email you that file, whether it's, you know, it's a TIFF image or a PDF or a JPEG, whatever it is. And so I think it's having that working relationship with the other side, I think, is important. Would you agree?
I would agree. I think, you know, there are certain things everyone's going to have their own issues during trial. So I think at that point, you know, being able to compromise on certain support points is always key in order for your own side to run smoothly. Let's move on to the morning of trial. Opening statement is going to begin. You know, they've already finished voir dire. And now, say you're the defendant, and you have to get ready for everything. How do you normally approach your first day of trial?
I try to get there early, and that goes back to circling back to making sure that you are working with the court clerk, and hopefully he or she lets you in early. And I go in there early to test for sound. I check the resolution on my machine, on my laptop. I check to see what the monitors look like. I go through and toggle through the switcher to make sure the power feeds are working, making sure that the cutoff to the jury switch is working, so through the projector. And I try to do that just to run through that. And I actually run through all of those processes every time I'm outside the courtroom and going back in, whether that's the morning break or lunch or coming back in the afternoon break. It's really important to run through those, just because you just never know what's going to happen. And I think it's just a process that you get used to doing. I make sure that I create a small video clip that I run to test for sound. And I think that's important, because sometimes with different depositions, there'll be different volumes. So it's important to know where you're at in terms of volume, because you don't want to play a clip that blasts through speakers as you start. But I think that's pretty much what we do on our end.
I think too, you know, kind of touching on being able to get there early is, you know, you go back to making friends with the court clerk. A lot of times the court clerk gets there and opens the doors or unlocks the doors at a certain time. So being able to kind of leverage that relationship that you have, they may let you in maybe a good 5-10 minutes earlier than that they were planning to. And, you know, I think going back to that relationship, that's something you definitely want to keep into account as a first day. You want to get there and early. And really what it comes down to is you don't want to feel rushed, and you want to make sure that your composure is all there, you're relaxed, because a lot of it too is you have to understand the attorneys are also fairly nervous, because they do have to present and it's the first day. And part of it is you're still trying to get into a rhythm of how the trial is going to be. So really they look to you to being relaxed and also ready for anything that may come up. Yeah, is there anything else that you want to consider for the first day of trial?
No, I think making sure that you're, other than your database, making sure your exhibits are there, making sure that you have the most updated exhibit list. I go through and check my images, make sure that they're right side up. You'd be surprised how often you'd be running through an exhibit and it turns out page 75 of 100 is actually landscape and should be portrait. So take the time to go through that. You could do it on the fly, but it doesn't look as clean. So make sure that you do that. I think that's important. Your video clips, go through your video clips ahead of time. Listen for if you're cutting off a question or you're cutting off an answer. So I think part of that is obviously pre-trial, but also the morning of, I just go through just for peace of mind to make sure those are all clean.
Have you had to ever deal with foreign language within any of your trials?
We did have an interpreter for one of my cases, and that was really the extent of it. How about you guys?
The reason I bring this up is because, especially when you're creating your video clips and you're testing them out, a lot of times the synchronization of the video doesn't essentially match the translation or the interpreter that's part of that video. So one of the things you do want to compensate for and at least be aware of is if you're dealing with anything that has foreign language in it, that when you're cutting the video clip, you're really doing a lot of the video editing, and that's something you definitely want to compensate for and at least let the trial team know that it's not as easy because of the fact that you do want to capture the interpretation and also the response of the actual designation that they're looking for. So that's something definitely to keep in mind pre-trial and also during trial if you have to bring up designations fairly quickly.
That's a great point. What about when you get into equipment redundancy? Is there anything that you bring in to make sure that you have some backup? And if so, can you talk about those?
Yeah, sure. So especially with with redundancy, it still goes back to the war room. You know, you always want to have two of something, especially if it's your trial laptop that you're going to use to present. You always make sure you have a hot swap that if for some reason your laptop just crashes, that you're able to, you know, take at least maybe a minute or two, apologize to the judge and to the jury, and, you know, be able to swap it out and plug right in. I think what also helps is making sure it's always the same model. It's the same image. You've tested this in and out, just like your primary laptop. It should also go the same way. One thing, too, that we do is we have everything really on the local hard drive of the laptop for us to bring up. But a lot of times I may have an encrypted hard drive with me just in case I need to bring something up that may have been corrupted at any point in time. So we always make sure that we have redundancy through and through. Well, what about yourself?
We do the same thing. I think going back to the switcher, having that second laptop, having it plugged into that switcher, that you can literally hit a switch. You may have your second laptop on sleep mode or, you know, hibernate mode so that you could bring it up fast. You know, with PCs, we know that it takes a little bit more time to boot up. So it may be a good idea to have it connected to your switcher. Get that switcher, you have a copy of that other your existing database on that other unit, and you're ready to go. I think piggybacking on, you know, making sure it's the same model, same image, is also making sure that you have the same version of the software you're running. You may or may not, you know, accidentally update one of your versions and not the other, and so it's important to check those, make sure you're running the same software, same version.
The one thing, too, that you should also remember is to bring batteries for anything that takes batteries, especially with clickers. The last thing you would ever want is during opening statement and suddenly the clicker stops working. So I would always recommend that you put in fresh batteries for trial and always keep spare batteries just in case someone has left on the clicker, you know, all night. So that's something you definitely want to consider.
Yeah, this particular tip is a non-technical tip, and it's something that we always do is bring a case of water. Bring a case of water for your attorneys. It's something that you don't think of, but they're so busy doing what they're doing. But it's good to have something to drink. They're tired. They've been talking all day long or in the middle of cross-examination. Their throat gets dry. Something as simple as just bring some water. Yeah. Other than your equipment, it's always good to have water in the courtroom.
Now, one thing, too, is mints. Bringing mints and everything else, because you have to understand mints do kind of keep you up. Given how tired you are and how everyone else is, you know, you have to account that everyone probably didn't sleep the night before, and yet everyone has been up since, like, early morning. So you definitely have a long day ahead of you, and it does help you kind of stay up. It's definitely something you want to take into account. I would not recommend using gum, just because the last thing anyone wants to hear is gum chewing within the courtroom.
Absolutely. So let's move on to dark days, dark weeks. How do you account for that? What do you do during that time?
Yeah. And that's interesting, because I think a lot of times too, and this goes back to just planning, someone may say, well, I expect the trial to be 3 weeks or 4 weeks. The thing I always ask them is, well, do you know if there are any dark days or any dark weeks during the span of trial? And the reason is because if you're renting equipment, you need to compensate for that. So it may be 3 weeks, but then if you have dark days or you have dark weeks, what may be 3 weeks could be 6 weeks. And that's something you definitely want to compensate for. And I think, too, with dark days is usually if there's time during the day that you shouldn't be in the courtroom, it's because they're normally allowing other parties to come in. So you may want to secure some of your equipment or ask the judge or the clerk what he or she would prefer to do with the courtroom equipment during that time.
We always overestimate the amount of time we're going to need that equipment. Vendors are very good about prorating what you've used, how long you've used that equipment. So I think it makes sense. Give yourself an extra couple days or depending on how many dark days you have or dark weeks, you can compensate that way. But I think it's always important just to give you a little bit more time, because we all know we've been in lots of trials and we all know they never end when they say they're going to end.
No, that's very true. I think, and that's something you definitely want to keep into account as you start to plan, and then especially during trial, what you're going to do with your equipment at that time. A lot of times, too, the vendor may discount they won't charge you for the dark week because of the fact, or there are just too many holidays. So they'll say, instead of actually returning the equipment and having to tear down your setup, they may just say, you know what, just keep it for the next week. It's better that you just have it there anyway. So that's definitely a point of negotiation, and you should consider that when you're planning for the courtroom.
Yeah, and I think, mentioning that some judges or some courtrooms will require you to tear down that equipment when you're laying out your cables, that's something to think about, is having extra slack in your cable so that you can move that equipment out of the way. And then be able to bring it back and tape it back down.
Yeah.
Let's talk about courtroom equipment. What do you use software-wise? What do you use to present? Can you talk a little bit about what you use on your end?
Sure. So what I've always noticed is that there's two types of courtroom presenters. There's people that like sanctions, people that like trial director. I personally have been a trial director person. That's what I grew up on. Really what it comes down to is you want to find the software that you're most comfortable with, whether it is Sanction, whether it is Trial Director. They are pretty much the cornerstone of any hot seat person's cachet of software. But, there definitely are other software that are out there. And really, I think it just comes down to practicing with it and finding what you're most comfortable with.
Yeah, absolutely. We use both Sanction and Trial Director here, and we've been using Sanction for about 10 years now, and I think Trial Director for the last 3 years or so. But you're right, there are a lot of other tools out there. You just have to find out what's the best fit for you. Ultimately, what you want to do is be able to show the jurors exhibits, show them videos, really make a compelling story on your end. And how do you do that? Well, you do that by software, being able to go through and show them exhibits on the fly and zoom out and call out sections that are important. We've had the ability to interview jurors through multiple trials and ask them what they thought of our presentation. And all of them thought, a great majority of them have always said they've appreciated the ability to see the visuals as opposed to having the other side using something like an Elmo and just placing it on and projecting that way and not having really the ability to zoom in and call out sections as easily as we were able to. So, Costa, you use Trial Director and Sanction. Do you use anything else? Do you use PowerPoint as well?
We do. We rely heavily on PowerPoint, especially, strictly for opening and closing statements. I think, essentially, you kind of want to stick to something a little static. You may have to toggle back to trial director or sanction during opening statement if you really need to pull up an exhibit and do call outs at that time. But I think for the most part, we do run everything through through PowerPoint. And you know, one of the things that we also do is we practice on the software all the way through. I would also note that on your laptop, for software, you want to make sure you have the right permissions, the right security for your laptop. So you may want to have local admin permissions for it, so that way you're not getting any type of errors that may come up for something being inaccessible. And that's something you definitely want to consider, and you'll definitely see that when you start to practice with the software.
Well, I think that's that leads into this additional point that having those rights, if you have to uninstall and reinstall, you need to have the ability to do that. And sometimes you have to reinstall that software, and if you get that, you don't have the rights to do so, you're really stuck there. Are you seeing any other tools on the market, you know, any of the other apps that are coming? And if so, you know, is that something that your firm has any interest in?
I think, we've had a lot of interest in using the iPad as a substitute for, you know, your traditional sanction or trial director to present on there. And we haven't essentially used it during trial, but we have used it for maybe some mock trials internally or just for practicing or presenting internally within our firm. I think eventually the industry will start to feel much more comfortable with using iPad type apps, and definitely have the right type of comfort level in order to actually do that. I guess so kind of what goes into something like that, since we haven't used it, is there anything in addition to just having the iPad and the app and everything else that you might want to consider?
You know, I think for us, we are looking at iJury. We're also looking at tools like eDepose that are all iPad driven. I think for us, you're right, that's, you know, iPad is it's a comfort level. There's a comfort level with tablets. I know Trial Director has an iPad version. We haven't used that yet. And we're seeing that attorneys are, you know, they're very tech savvy. The days of attorneys not wanting to bring technology in the courtroom are far behind us. The fact that, years ago, attorneys did not want to have a big fancy presentation because they thought we looked like the big bad law firm, I think, are behind us as well. So there are tools in the market that make it easy for them to create these presentations, create these compelling, stories, and to tell the jurors about their client's side. And so I think iPads are really going to be what we're going to see in the future. And I think we're going to see more attorneys who are going to have that comfort level to use those in the courtroom.
Have you ever run into situations where you're getting ready for trial, get everything situated, and then the trial team decides that maybe the second or third chair would be the one manning the hot seat?
We have run into that, and more often than not, after the first couple of days of trial, they realize that they really do need a dedicated trial person, whether it's that person later on in the day cutting videos and creating new additional exhibits that have been brought in and call outs. So we've been fortunate to have a full-time trial team that seems to be busy all year long every year since we've had them. So I think the benefits of having a dedicated person who is really focused on your presentation, telling your story, doing your edits, and making sure that you're courtroom equipment and your war room equipment really pays dividends to make sure that person is there. And a lot of times the lawyers are there to lawyer. They're there to examine the witnesses and prep our clients. So I think ultimately having somebody that's dedicated to sit in that hot seat and do that work for you, I think is really the end goal that I think the clients end up really appreciating.
Yeah, I think also the one thing too is if you run into that type of situation is let them do an audition. You don't want to discount them and say you can't do it. But I think part of it too is you just want to make sure that they are comfortable if they do decide to do it, that they are comfortable with the equipment and the technology and that they're able to do it efficiently. And sometimes if you're auditioning for it, they may say, yeah, you do this because like you said, I'm there to lawyer. I'm there to figure out strategy, or to even sometimes just keep an eye on the jury and see how the jury is responding to certain points made during trial. So, you know, I think a lot of that is, you know, obviously we try to persuade our attorneys, and I think we do a really good job of showing them the value of having us strictly work on the hot seat, because, you know, they don't call it the hot seat for anything. There's a lot of pressure on you in order to do that, and they already have enough pressure just sitting there at the counsel table.
Great. I think we covered some really key parts of trial prep and trial support, courtroom equipment. I think some inside tips about a few of those do's and don'ts that I think are going to be very helpful to listeners. Anything else that we want to sign off with, Acosta, before we wrap this up?
No, I think you covered a lot of things. I think for this podcast, if anyone does have any questions, please feel free to reach out to Quente or myself, Chris Acosta.
Great. Thank you, everybody.
You've been listening to ILTA Radio. Subscribe to ILTA's podcasts through iTunes or Podbean and get alerted about new recordings. ILTA Radio. Get tuned in.